Duck, duck, goose!
The Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and today I'm talking to Kelsey Atherton and Adam Elkis. Kelsey, why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself?
All right. I have been blogging on and off for years. I currently write at Plastic Manzikert and blog Tarkin, which we'll be discussing later. Trying to break into the IR scene, but really just they're enjoying the blogging community at present.
And what's your background?
I graduated from Tulane in 11, I'm an undergrad in political science and Middle Eastern history. And my main focus since then in writing and blogging and commenting has been largely on the intersection of new technology or games and strategy.
Okay, and Adam, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Adam Elkis. I'm an incoming PhD student at American University. I also blog at Vumukuama Information Dissemination and CTO Vision and my own blog, Rethinking Security.
So how do you two know each other?
The internet.
Twitter.
Adam, I rudely interrupted you when you were about to tell us a little bit more about your educational background, I think, right?
Yeah, I just was about to mention that I graduated from a Georgetown Security Studies program last December. That's it.
Okay. And both of you, it sounds like, are kind of among the wunderkunds of the national security blogging scene, and I've noticed there's been an invasion of younger, autodidactic bloggers lately. But I was asking how you two know each other basically through blogging, is that right?
Adam here, and that's definitely correct.
Kelsey here. It's, yeah, through blogging and Twitter. The War Kids Loop pulled a lot of young NatSec blogger types together, and that's how we met.
I've actually been very impressed by the cohesiveness and vibrancy of the national security Twitter and blogging scene, and this particular interface between policy practitioners, people I'll call sort of autodidacts, self-starters, although that's not, you know, no man is an island educationally or intellectually, and then also academics. Maybe before we get into this particular experiment that you guys are doing, you could talk a little bit more about that scene.
Kelsey, why don't you go on ahead?
Okay. Kelsey here. So the scene, as I've seen it, I've only been in D.C. for just approaching a year, but I was able to partake in the Twitter community long before that, and what you get is really interesting, fast and punchy commentary and analysis about issues of the moment or whatever someone is thinking about or writing on at the time and decides to throw out into the void. And then because there's no real barrier to entry in Twitter, everyone, you're able to have long conversations back and forth and interesting exchanges of ideas with people in the field who are addressing the actual, who are writing seriously about the real issues for think tanks and other policy places that matter.
Adam here, and I think also one of the great benefits of it is that Kelsey and I both came from sort of disparate parts of the U.S. that were not necessarily known for engagement in politics, him New Orleans and me Los Angeles. And being in D.C., we all have the chance to hang out, talk about things that we really like. And there's definitely a social element to it that's very rewarding and important in a way that I certainly never dreamed of when I first came to D.C.
So what you're saying is that it's not simply a virtual scene, but there's a sort of active, social, concrete, real-life, brick-and-mortar side to this community?
Adam here. That's certainly correct. There's a term that's in sociology of the internet called digital dualism, which sort of refers to the idea that your interaction on Facebook is somehow separate from what you do in the real world. And DC is definitely something that just proves that that's really not the case, and that a lot of the things that, like, Kelsey and I and our friends Dan and Rob and Alex talk about on Twitter are the same things we tend to talk about when we're in person at house parties, bars, cafes, and so on.
Kelsey, did you want to get in on that?
What Adam said is very much correct. And it's definitely the social scene that this online community fostered, and then it goes back and forth, and there really isn't. It's weird making the distinction, because this is just more or less the social scene that I experience. It's whether it be online or not. But I remember very clearly being an undergrad and writing about these things in New Orleans, where international politics was not the forefront of anyone's mind, really. It was still nice to be able to participate. And so it's very much a DC thing that it is the whole of life, but it's the online NatSec community Twitter exchange it's really nice that it can take place across the nation.
Well, I hope you don't mind that I'm pressing you on these issues. If you've followed some of my and Charlie's writings on this issue, we're very interested in the ways in which Web 2.0 technologies have resulted in a blurring of some of the hierarchies that exist, whether they be academic, non-academic, or student, professor, or and the similar effects that those are having, kind of both horizontally with the policy community, but also vertically within some aspects of the policy community. Obviously, I wouldn't go so far as to say that the hierarchies created by people's service in government or being an assistant secretary of this, that, or the other thing have been broken down yet by these kinds of communities of discourse. But certainly the way that one enters the think tank world and gets a voice in some of those policy discussions seems to have altered from when I was, say, just coming out of college. So I was curious what your experience of it is like. It sounds like an interesting mix of kind of active online discussion in a variety of different formats, but also a sort of offline social experience where you're seeing the same people over and over again and reinforcing that community and those networks. Is that unfair? Is that right?
Kelsey, why don't you go ahead on that
first? I think it is. It's entirely possible my social circle is an outlier, but I don't think it is. There's very much a blurring of that online, online-offline dichotomy. In life here, and to get to the hierarchy comment, one of the more interesting things I've observed in the DC community is this might just be a small set of the wonk community, but there's Twitter Fight Club, which happens at about the same time as March Madness, is where people, and they really range from interns to one of the highest echelons of our, some of the more established names in the policy community. We had several well-established journalists. We had Spencer Ackerman of Wired, Dan Dresner of Foreign Policy. Anne-Marie Slaughter participated this year. We'll engage with interns or with just hobbyists or other voices in trying to have like a tournament of a series of bouts about providing valuable content and wonkiness on Twitter. And that's a very clear blurring of the lines that you have people entering fairly equally into discourse, and then a fun ranked system to make the people following along enjoy it.
All right. Well, I'm going to force you all to move on to the topic that I lured you into this discussion with, which is that you and a group of other bloggers or people in this community have established an interesting experiment called Grand Blog Tarkin. For our listeners, would you elaborate on the concept and what exactly this is?
Certainly. Kelsey here, if I may. Grand Blanc Tarkin was born out of a discussion between myself and Captain Brett Friedman of the U.S. Marines about how there's a lot of wonks have been writing or paying attention using that their analytical abilities to science fiction, to other sources, and there's lots of writing on it. Dan Dresner has made a good name for himself as the wonk who writes on zombies, among other things. But the wonk who writes on zombies, and I have been writing a lot on the intersection of video game modeling of strategic situations. And we thought that what the community was really lacking was a unified place to put all this analytical thought about fiction. Treating it as both study in and of itself, but also as commentary on the world as is. There were a couple pieces that came out, I think, around early June about what does the video game say about the decade at war. And we thought it would be nice if there was a response from the people who have been writing about war, in Brett's case, fighting the war, and broadly thinking about the relation between our culture and our strategy. And Blog Tarkin seemed to be a fitting title, taking an imperial strategist and going with it.
I'd observe too that I think that a lot of people who are interested in strategy, there tends to be a certain crossover between that and science fiction, because science fiction has a set of internally, and fantasy have a set of internally consistent rules and worlds that are built. And just as strategists like contemplating the way that various rules, such as geography, politics, or certain weapons technologies, enable certain courses of action in real life, I think that there is a very big influence on the other side. Sometimes, too, I think people's impressions of science fiction also really impact their idea of policy as well. Me and my friend Alex Olesker wrote for CTO Vision about how William Gibson's writings on Neuromancer had some good things and also some fairly bad things for the way people think about cyber strategy.
That sounds really interesting. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what some of those bad things that Gibson has bequeathed to the cybersecurity community?
Well, I guess one of the biggest things is the digital dualism idea that I mentioned earlier. And the term's not mine. It was coined by Nathan Jurgensen, who blogs at Cyborgology. It was a collection of digital sociologists. But one of the things that you see reflected in science in cyberpunk in the 80s is the idea that when people enter some kind of virtual space that's somewhat disembodied, and the rules in that space are inherently different than the rules in meat space, so to speak, to use Gibson's phrase. Whereas in reality, we're always fairly embodied through the technologies we use. And cyberspace, there are aspects of cyberspace that are certainly that of a designed environment, but at the same time, cyberspace is also still governed by the laws of electromagnetics, and it also reflects actions human beings take that create effects in other domains.
It sounds almost like a replication of the old saw of mind-body dualism, right, now only applied where cyberspace stands in for the mind or the spirit of old. I mean, is that...
I definitely was thinking about that because I've been reading your colleague and my old professor, Patrick Thaddeus Jackson's book about the implications of that for research science. But there's definitely a parallel to that. And some of the consequences of that is that people think somehow that different rules necessarily apply in cyberspace. Like, I'll give you a fairly casual example, is that most people say that cyber crimes are uniquely difficult to prosecute, but chances are if someone steals your bicycle in D.C., MPD's not going to find it either. There is a certain commonality that goes to, because human behavior stays consistent whatever the technological medium.
Okay, well, that makes a ton of sense. Where did you say that we could find that essay again?
It's at the blog CTO Vision. A bit of a full disclosure. I do write for the company that's behind it, called Crucial Point LLC, as does Alex Olesker. But the title is How Cyberpunk Killed Cybersecurity.
But we would not find that precisely at Grand Blog Tarkin.
Adam here again. Generally, the stuff that I've seen people write at Grand Blog Tarkin are things where they take a look at a fictional world, say, and then look at some kind at the way within the internally consistent rules of that world, you see a strategy play out, like John Jekyll, who's an army officer who has interests in operational art, did a piece this week looking at how the Jedis in the Star Wars prequels lacked any real concept of operational art or even necessarily grand tactics. They're in very individualist fighters, reliant on fairly unimaginative tactics once you move beyond the realm of single combat.
And other things, Kelsey here, other things we have discussed, there was a great piece by Dana Stisher on, there's a two-parter about the Batman Incorporated series by DC, where Batman franchises out vigilantism across the world, and what does that mean to have, what are the long-term implications of an American citizen setting up multiple, like, vigilante organizations all over that are non-state actors, and also probably in, he highlights a case where one of the Batman is very much against the corruption of the government that's hosting him, and how that gets very messy internationally very fast. So we've talked a lot, really, about spaceships and superheroes have been the main topics so far.
Yeah, I've noticed that there's a kind of, I mean, just scrolling through the blog right now, I see posts on Mass Effect, Star Wars, Batman, Firefly, Aliens. This is pretty much a visual media coverage. Are there plans to move into, for example, traditional science fiction novels or traditional print media?
There absolutely is. Someone I know is working on a piece that it's still Star Wars centric, but it's focused on the expanded universe stuff, which is the tremendous amount of novels that have been set there. That is, while it's still, I guess it's still based in the visual medium and the touch point of Star Wars, but that is books, and there's plans to go other places with it. Right now, we just got the nice pictures up.
So what are the things that any kind of activity like this, well, there are a number of kinds of questions and issues that any kind of activity like this raises, and I was wondering what you thought about some of them. The big issue for me, I mean, it's really fun to read, kind of analyses of where the Jedi went wrong in Star Wars, or how should we understand the Cerberus organization in Mass Effect as a kind of supremacist, shadowy, transnational movement, but on an intergalactic scale. All that stuff's a great deal of fun. But obviously there's a very complicated interchange between something like science fiction and existing representations of strategy and warfare in the quote-unquote real world. Right, such that it's not clear to me what the status is of an artifact like Mass Effect or an analysis of Jedi strategy, what the sort of status of that is for thinking about strategy in general, strategy in the non-fictional world, and so forth. And what kinds of opinions do you have of those sorts of issues?
Adam here, I'll take a stab at that. It's something that's, it is a legitimate question in the sense of, if you have a completely fictional world with a set of different rules, what justification do you necessarily have to apply strategic concepts from elsewhere? And, I mean, the first aspect of that is the distinction that Clausewitz makes between war and warfare. War being a relationship between two sides, both legal, ethical, moral, and physical in the sense of war as a duel. And that aspect has stayed consistent for the entirety of human history because it's based on fairly immutable characteristics derived from the human conflict. Whereas warfare, the actual, is constantly shifting, and it's based on a number of things that are contextual, geography, politics, and so on. And in a sense of that, I guess we all make somewhat of an implicit assumption when we're writing that no matter if we're necessarily talking about alien races or superheroes, that war is war, but that the actual contextual area of those worlds shapes the warfare of it significantly. In terms of, though, like the sort of the actual practical utility of these explorations, some of them are honestly things that we do because we're interested in writing about them. Others sort of like others do have lessons. I did one on the Batman, but more broadly the superhero genre in general, about the concept of disarming the enemy and how a lot of the superhero genre mirrors a lot of ways that people think about force today, in the idea of being able to disarm or defeat someone fairly frictionlessly without collateral damage and without messy ethical choices.
Kelsey here, to take off from there, I think another one of the more interesting pieces, one of the pieces that helped actually spark the creation of Blog Tarkin was written by soldier Don Gomez at Carrying the Gun, where he was responding to two articles about how, what does Call of Duty say about, what does the latest Call of Duty say about a nation that spent a decade at war? And they're flashy all, they're morally ambiguous in a very forced kind of way, games. And what he was, his counterpoint was that Mass Effect is a much better example or much better artifact from our decade of war for understanding what the conflicts are like, where Mass Effect, 95% of the action in Mass Effect isn't really action. It's talking to people, it's managing different characters' balances, different groups, getting them coordinated, figuring that out, balancing the needs of a disparate coalition, and then 5% of it is maybe kinetic action. But you go into that hopefully knowing how it's going to be. You figured that out already through your long, elaborate negotiating and talking and just kind of the grunt work, really, of the game. And so that was... So that piece was a soldier relating his game experience to what has been more like his war experience. And Brett Friedman actually opens with a longer meditation on that, with war emotion in Mass Effect.
Well, see, but here's the I would push you all on this, because what you're getting at is a very complex set of interplays, or, you know, to take the post-structuralist term, intertextual relationships between the artifacts like science fiction, or more precisely, like artifacts like games, speculative fiction as text, speculative fiction as media, other types of fictional genres, fictional elements, and then representations of conflict that purport to be first order, right? That purport to be about actual conflict itself rather than, you know, purport to be mediated versions of that. So some of the ways you're talking about what you're doing at Grand Blog Tarkin, you know, is essentially to treat something like Mass Effect as an ethnographic data point, right? So what kinds of representations are being tossed out of the industrialized West after a decade of conflict in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, right? And then sort of second order questions, which of those representations are more accurate or are better representations? Some of the other things, though, you're talking about are kind of, you know, in a sense, Adam's example of discrete use of force and collateral damage is a pretty good example of this. You know, hey, look, there's this element of unreality in superhero movies, and because we know the superhero movies are unreal, we can say this is not realistic. But if you think about it, it's actually consistent with ways that we're thinking about the use of force in the real world, drone operations, et cetera, et cetera. Ergo, the critical move then being to say, if it's unrealistic in Batman, why do we think it's at all plausible in, you know, American foreign policy? And so that's all, I sort of get that. That's all really well and good, and you've done some really interesting work on the blog, and it sounds like coming up in that kind of idiom. But there's this other kind of dimension to this stuff, which is that if you take something like, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars or Neon Genesis Evangelion, right, all of which are products of particular moments in, you know, popular culture and the zeitgeist in international affairs, they will have certain ways of thinking about that they represent combat or struggle or strategy that both pick up on a series of contemporaneous understandings, but also may essentially be shorthands to broader cultural understandings within the you know, traditions that they draw upon, whether those be science fiction or in Star Wars, for example, the sort of whole tradition of good rebellion against empire, which, you know, reaches down to the level in Star Wars of representing the empire as having British accents, which is a common trope in Mideast epics, right? The Romans always have British accents, and the good guys always have American accents. So there's this very complicated interplay that you're dealing with in which any of these narratives is going to have a series of shorthand that's designed to give them plausibility, is going to have a series of constructed elements or constructed worlds that are designed to entertain us, to tap into our imaginations, and then also are going to have attempts to buttress their credibility, not through references to fictional genres, but to kind of real situations, and sometimes they're making commentary upon them. So that's a very complicated, complex stew to be trying to extract particular directions of meaning or commentary out of. And so I wanted to push you on how you're thinking about that, or how various pieces deal with that complexity of dialogue between various fictional and non-fictional elements.
Well, I think one of the pieces that was so engaging for me was the international relations and the Batman series, which very much the Batman is a character that's been continuously reinterpreted. We have in the cinema right now the latest Nolan. Nolan one, and it's played different roles throughout decades. There was the 80s revival with Dark Knight Returns under Frank Miller, had a very distinct feel, different than it, even though the latest movies borrow its title, distinct from that. And I think one of the really interesting things that was done with the Batman Incorporated, it was talking about, like, it was very clearly using these tropes, using this established, very familiar character, and then setting it with a non-state and multinational actor, vigilante, which gives it a whole layer of commentary, because Batman is he's American, he's an American hero, he has this established pedigree as this good person on the side of justice, but then you throw him abroad and you get a very interesting commentary for what kind of things happen when you have so wide a reach and so unaccountable one as the vigilante allows, as the non-state actor allows. I don't know exactly what that specifically says about our culture, but I think it's one of the more interesting frames for looking at it. That was something, it feels very much that Batman Incorporated was something that could only come up during the global war on terror. It would have seemed very out of place, I think, in any other era.
Well, that's one of the things that's really exciting about using superheroes as a medium. And, you know, it's funny, when I was first looking at Grand Blog Tarkin, I was much more taken with the sort of Star Wars, Mass Effect, the big science fiction space opera universes, often which have all of these elements of grand strategy, grand politics, etc. But with superheroes, right, superheroes are basically our folk heroes, right? A lot of the major superhero figures like Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, etc., essentially have the same status that legendary heroes or folk tale heroes would have had in the 17th, 16th, 15th century, right? Batman is comparable in many ways to Arthur in terms of his position within our popular imagination. And like those heroes, these are characters who are reinterpreted over and over and over again. Of course, the difference is that they have copyrights attached to them, and that has certain implications for their use and recycling. But so you can really get, as you suggest, a kind of, you know, let's look at the evolution of these figures over time and the way they're deployed to make different kinds of arguments that I think you can do a lot with. But at the same time, right, Nolan is making a conscious, you know, not only is he sort of, is his vision of Batman, you know, is the sort of post 9/11 Batman, or that Batman Incorporated is a vision of a kind of globalization era Batman. Not only are they products of their environment, but they're also conscious arguments, right? They're interventions and ongoing political debates using these figures as ways, reappropriating these figures within the constraints offered by their mythology to make very specific claims, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons why the Dark Knight is such a powerful film, is that it's an argument about what the consequences of the war on terror for society. But that's very different than dealing with a kind of situation. I mean, so again, you're back to the sort of question about how do you sort of juggle this is an emergent product of our culture and times, and we're going to read it that way, with the fact that there's ethereal intent to make a particular kind of claim about something.
Adam here, and I'll take that up. First thing, and it's kind of a bit of a delayed response to one of your earlier questions before this, is to some extent, I think every contributor has a different purpose, often kind of differing by the day in necessarily engaging with the subject. Some of them have didactic purposes, others are doing it more for the fun of it. And some want to look within the framework of context, in the sense of what does Dark Knight say, or Call of Duty say, about the war on terror and the specific cultural artifact. It's sort of, in a way, you can kind of consider it as being, I guess, the internet equivalent of an edited academic volume. Every contributor has a different method, not all of which is even necessarily explicit within that contributor's own mind. But I guess one thing that I at least am somewhat cautious about when I write is that there's a bit of a tradition online in which people writing about a certain science fiction artifact either to make a didactic point, or doesn't have too much to do with the artifact in question, or to use that artifact to make a somewhat superficial argument. And for all of us, even though we are fans, we all put a good deal of effort into what we do, and we also have a degree of seriousness to it. To some degree, we may do that sort of contextual dive in the future, and I think that some of the stuff that has been on the blog in bits and pieces has kind of approached it, but we also want to do it in a credible manner. I mean, I spend a lot of time emailing Kelsey examples of how it's not done in the hopes that he'll, my selfish hope that he'll write a SmackDown post for my entertainment.
Yeah, I'm not being fair to you, because I'm basically asking you questions that people like I and Ivor Neumann have been wrestling with ever since we got into the pop culture and IR gig, and I'm asking them in long-winded ways that throw too much at you. So I will say that that the blog is really an excellent example of how to do these kinds of analyses, and I think I take Adam's point very well, that a lot of the stuff that has come out in the last couple of years, for example, about the politics, the occasional posts on the politics of Star Wars or on Battlestar Galactica or on Game of Thrones, is really so superficial that, you know, those of us who have invested more time in these, both these genres and the issues, you know, want to bang our heads against the wall. And that's not something you see on Grand Blog Tarkin. So I think that you've been very successful at moving beyond the the, gee, I want to make a point about realism. There's some power politics in Game of Thrones, so look, it's realist.
Yeah.
If I may jump in for a moment, Kelsey here, and one of the, you were talking about how the Dark Knight Rises has been used for a lot of political arguments, and I've seen it argued as everything from benevolent Toryism to fascism to classical liberalism, and there are, that's fine for people to make those arguments, but what we're concerned about at Grand Blog Tarkin is why Batman led police officers in a frontal assault against tanks with pistols. Where there's a lot of philosophy you can do on these things, and it's good to do that, but a lot of the philosophizing we've seen, or certainly some of it that happens, is how does this media reflect my views?
Why do you think there's so much? Why do you think there are so many people who write about politics or foreign policy, and who also are bloggers, who, for whom it really matters whether or not the Dark Knight Rises or Battlestar Galactica is consistent with their political beliefs, or why it matters to them that they can try to why it matters to them that they can at least interpret these franchises as consistent with their political beliefs?
Adam here, I'll take that off again. I guess it comes down to that. I mean, there's always been a fairer running debate in literary criticism, which is probably I think where a lot of this discussion I think is moving towards. As in, does an author conclusively determine the meaning of a text? And I mean, is there meaning outside the text? How does one interpret it? And I'm not a literary criticism guy. I'm an IR, poli-science, strategic studies guy, so I can only really dabble in that sort of area. But I think that I definitely believe that people that people remix culture, to use the term of the book, and we have very strikingly individual experiences with our media, and oftentimes we impose move to an essay that Susan Sontag wrote in the mid-60s about her talking about the problem of literary criticism, and that people search for meanings in the text that maybe are not necessarily there and impose them to be there. And it's always a hazard whenever you're doing any kind of criticism, because you have to make a certain wager about your ability to interpret something, or whether or not the meaning of what the author says necessarily is final. I mean, with something like, you see that in kind of a very vulgar way, in the sense with Dark Knight, in which Christopher Nolan says, well, my film is not about any of this, and he'll acknowledge a specific influence of, I base the scenes of Bane's anarchism off the Tale of Two Cities. But even him declaring that it's about something is not enough to stop people from imposing different meanings, remixing, and so on and so on. I mean, it's their right. It's entirely human, and I certainly have done so a lot in the past in casual conversations with friends. It's just that when we write, we try to at least, imperfectly, albeit, avoid some of the traps involved in that kind of criticism.
Well, I'm sorry, Kelsey, you were going to jump in?
I was going to jump in just for a moment. I think it's also, as you mentioned, these are, especially with superheroes, these are folktales, but even with other science fiction, these are very, very shared stories. And I think there's just an innate want for the hero to be your guy.
All right. Well, I think that probably sums up that line of argument. It does seem to me that people get really invested in these characters and in these films and in these megatexts, as we call them, in a way that might be considered borderline obsessive, such that I don't know if you all were around when Battlestar Galactica did its New Caprica occupation sequence, but there were a number of conservative bloggers who were just loving Battlestar Galactica, and from their writings you could just tell that they felt betrayed, slapped in the face, otherwise horrified that this text that they were so invested in might raise the possibility that there's moral ambiguity surrounding suicide terrorism, or that suicide terrorism might be comparable, as the character in the episode says, to sending a fighter pilot on a mission which you're pretty sure that they're not going to survive. And so I think Kelsey's answer does a good job of explaining that. You know, you just really love these characters, and you therefore want them to be consistent with your worldview. But that's something that you are trying to avoid in Granblog Tarkin, and part of the way that it looks like you're trying to do that is by maintaining a very critical stance towards the text that you're looking at. You know, not sort of treating them as objects of love and affection, although there's clearly a lot of affection for these texts, but saying, you know, look, this just doesn't make any sense, or this is not a good way to represent things, or that was, gosh, my heroes made a really stupid strategic decision in this episode of The Clone Wars. And is that something that you've been very conscious about trying to make sure that you do?
Kelsey here. I think so. I think part of, at least my experience of how we, the kind of people who think this thing analytically like this, appreciate fiction is they're always and looking very critically at it and like, oh, well, here's where the character screwed up, or they should have made that decision better, or it's so obvious that this was the right course. I mean, and it's really frustrating to be able to watch something and to see a frontal. We had a long discussion on Twitter and on through other means online about the prevalence of frontal assaults in science fiction, and they look very dramatic, and you get the sense of two sides colliding into each other, but they're really stupid. They're really, really stupid in almost everything, unless both sides are wearing, even if both sides are wearing armor, there are better ways to do this. And I think we can't quiet the part of us that says that, so now we write about it and point out this flaw.
What I find really interesting about that particular problem is that in general, a lot of science fiction has been on the cutting edge of military tactics and technology, and often in ways that you go back and read science fiction of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and you think, wow, they really got it wrong. You know, that makes it feel anachronistic and dated in retrospect because their imaginary futures didn't pan out. But if you think about the current imaginary future of warfare, doesn't look like full frontal assaults. It looks decentralized, distributed, etc. Can you think of any evidence of say the remote strike complex ideas the Russians formulated and we're now kind of have been putting into effect to some degree showing up in science major science fiction artifacts?
Adam here. I think if you're talking about the reconnaissance strike complex,
yes,
yeah, the military technical revolution and so on and so on. I feel like I'm about to put on a Depeche Mode record here, but carry on. I think that sort of aspect of warfare doesn't really tend to be too present in a lot of science fiction because, I mean, at the end of the day, we're also dealing with a narrative medium. And I think that it's very easy for a writer to kind of invest something with human drama when it's a bunch of guys clashing each other or you have spaceships firing at line of sight rather than necessarily you think about the Aegis missile system aboard naval craft during the Cold War. You switch them on, you shoot missiles at each other. It goes faster than humans can calculate, which is why you rely on heavily automated tools. There's not necessarily the same kind of human drama in that. And I think that that's something that science fiction writers have sort of proven themselves fairly hard to part from. I mean, again, like a lot of science fiction dramas in space, they have fighters doing dogfights in somewhat of a World War II or even a World War II style. But the thing is that, I mean, that air-to-air combat now embraces the beyond visual range dimension where you're firing missiles at each other and you're not even going to see the enemy pilot or his plane. And I guess that science fiction writers struggle to be able to represent that kind of warfare in a way that's palpable or understandable to audiences without detailed knowledge of military history or tactics. And I think that it takes a lot of creative imagination to do so. And I'm still waiting for someone to kind of embrace the beyond visual range dimension. The only thing I can really think of is the one Star Trek episode where the two planets were firing missiles at each other.
Well, you know, you might, this is potentially an argument for moving beyond visual media and looking more at science fiction texts, because I can certainly think of, although there's a lot more going on, some of which is inconsistent with what we're talking about, but if you think about, say, Stephen Donaldson's Chaos and Order, are either of you familiar with that book?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a book that, you know, the entire book is a 24-hour space battle in which a lot of the action is essentially measures and countermeasures taken at computer speed, right? Or if you think about Ian M. Banks's Culture space battles, often of which are, again, they're beyond visual range of it. His gimmick is that because he has sentient AIs, they can sort of provide some sense of what's going on. But again, they are happening over very short time frames beyond visual range in ways that would not be recognizable in the dogfight idiom that Star Wars really saddled us with, because Lucas thought that, you know, fighter pilots were the equivalent of our knights, and so he would represent his heroes that way in that film. So have you thought about branching out more towards texts that where you might get out of some of the narrative constraints that you see in film and other visual media?
Kelsey here. We have absolutely thought about that. We're a very young blog. I think this is we went live about 3 weeks ago Friday. So we're certainly going to take on and tackle other things. We haven't yet, but it's on the list.
So are you happy with the amount of attention that the blog's receiving?
Adam here. We're definitely happy about it. But I mean, when we started it, we were just a kind of a bunch of friends who wanted to write about science fiction and strategy. So even if it wasn't there, it would be still worthwhile to us, because it did evolve out of conversations on bars, on Twitter, and in email lists.
All right. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to share some of your thoughts and your ideas, not only your background and your and the dynamics of the national security blogging scene, but also in particular this really interesting and exciting grand blog Tarkin experiment that you all have instituted. I know that it's on my RSS feed, and I've already linked into it a couple times, and I'm sure that as the posts continue to challenge us through science fiction to think about issues in contemporary politics and strategy, that it will get even more attention. So thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Dan. I hope you write us a guest blog, too.
I'll have to come up with an idea worthy of the blog for that. This concludes episode number 3 of the Duck of Minerva podcast, recorded on the 2nd of August, 2012.